FM. Welcome back to BCFM's politics show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. How did child sex criminal Jimmy Savile escape arrest for decades? Was he protected by a wider network? Did that network include the police and the BBC? We hear from someone who's spoken to his victims. Plus, as three more patsies are arrested by the FBI, the latest on the Boston bombings cover-up. When the NATO's own Bilderberg power elite come to Hertfordshire in June, there's only two things to do: arrest them all for fraud and war crimes, or party. But it looks like the latter will be more likely, since these lot seem to own the Serious Fraud Office and the International Criminal Court in The Hague. So we take a look at the Bilderberg Fringe Festival. Plus, tomorrow's May Day march and rally from College Green reaches Castle Park around about 12:30, and it's bringing together critics of the coalition government from all over the region. We speak to one of them. Plus, Martin Summers will take us on his weekly tour of the world's hotspots. But first, the Jimmy Savile case. 18 months ago, senior BBC managers censored the transmission of evidence exposing Britain's worst ever paedophile. Instead, they aired a Christmas tribute to Jimmy Savile. Under the guiding hand of the failed Tory cabinet minister Chris Patten, hundreds of thousands of pounds of licence fee payers' money was spent on various reports, but nobody was sacked. So, how did Savile get away with raping and sexually abusing children for decades, and are the shadowy managers who protected him still getting away with it? Was he protected by a wider network of child rapists inside, outside the BBC? Well, to discuss this, I'm joined on the line by a psychoanalyst specialising in trauma and director of London's Clinic for Dissociative Studies, Valerie Sinnerson. Hi, Valerie, and welcome to Drive Time.
Hello.
Hello, Valerie. I thought you weren't there for a second.
Oh, right.
Now, you actually, first of all, can you just tell us about the Clinic for Dissociative Studies?
Yes, it was founded 13 years ago. I was a child psychotherapist at the Tavistock Clinic, which is one of the biggest health service training and treatment centres for outpatient psychotherapy. And I was mainly working with children with a learning disability who'd gone through horrendous amounts of abuse as a vulnerable group that find it hard to communicate or be believed. And while doing that work, I was asked to supervise a case in Sweden, which was a woman who had been even more sadistically treated by her staff members. And it was through doing that work that we started a pilot study looking at people making allegations of extreme trauma, such awful accounts of multiple moments of trauma at the hands of many people, that the response was one of disbelief rather than greater sympathy and protection. And I decided to start a new clinic to help those, because it seemed very strange that a group of children and adults who were already vulnerable, the more they suffered, somehow the less they were believed. So it's not surprising that in that first group I worked with over 20 years ago, I had two accounts of Jimmy Savile being an abuser, where I did support two people to go to the police, but it was seen as something impossible to consider at that time.
Seen by whom?
Seen by the police as real, but also by the wider community. We have improved a lot as a society in the last 20 years in accepting the reality of abuse, even though it's still so hard for us.
Now, Valerie, when someone has experienced this kind of abuse, where do they normally go to talk about it? And does it take them a few bounces before they find someone that will believe them, like you?
When we look at adults who were abused in childhood, we find that nearly all of them had told somebody. And often it could have been a fellow pupil at school, a teacher, a helpline, a neighbor. But depending on how that first person reacted, the victim can often shut up for another 10 years. Just even a kind of well-meaning teacher saying, oh, I'm sure your mum is a really nice woman and maybe you've got it wrong in your mind. I don't think she'd do something like that. Just somebody well-meaningly speaking like that can make a child then unable to speak and go through another 10 years of abuse. And similarly, going to a police officer, again, it's changed now. The culture of the police has changed dramatically, but 20 years ago, when even counsellors and social workers didn't think abuse could be so widespread, the police were obviously part of that culture too. I mean, it's hard to realise that in the 1980s, there was a point where it was thought there were only 486 children on the abuse register. Now, the government accepts that one in four adults will have been abused at some point in their lives. That is a huge change.
Now, Valerie, how was it that you actually, how could you actually, did you yourself speak to the police at the time of speaking to Savile's victims? Or did you, you said you helped them to go, but what's that process? And if the police don't listen, can you actually sort of weigh in and say, hang on, you really should listen to these people? Is there anything you can do personally?
I think it's much easier to be a forceful advocate now than it was in that period 20 years ago, that where somebody said no and you said, but I want this taken up at a higher level, you could be told, I'm sorry, this person is a vulnerable victim. I don't think the Crown Prosecution Service will back this going any further. They're likely to break down in court. We don't think this has got a chance of going anywhere, and we are not sure that it's true. This is really different for any survivors listening now. If a police officer doesn't listen sympathetically and offer a believing response, then something has gone wrong, because the police really do have this in their guidelines now.
Okay, going back to these victims, what did they tell you about what Savile had actually done?
Well, what will be really awful for people listening, outside of those that may have read it in a couple of the newspapers that reported it, was that Savile was not only abusing all children with and without disabilities in group settings, in individual settings, in hospital settings, he was also invoking belief systems, doing rituals, making children believe he had extra powers, and that if they didn't obey him, they'd also be punished in an afterlife.
Well, in what way? How could he do that? I mean, surely, I know that there's been this headline about your work talking about satanic rituals, but, I mean, does that actually bear any relevance to any kind of real religion, or did you think it was just done to scare the children?
That's a really important differentiation. First of all, can I make clear that there are Satanists that would never harm anybody? It's a legal belief system. And I've met many Satanists who became Satanists because their churches were threatening them with the most horrendous punishments in an afterlife for having done wrong things, and they became Satanists in order to feel they could die safely and wouldn't be tortured in an afterlife. So please let me say that first of all, that when I talk about Satanist abuse, I am in no way saying all Satanists are abusers, any more than when we speak about abuse by Catholic priests, we're saying all priests. So, but where Satanists are abusers too, then there are extra things in, especially, for example, Aleister Crowley, that can be used to frighten children more. But the use of cloaks, of making spells, of making threats, of threatening what will happen after death too, is something that the five different people that have spoken to me about Jimmy Savile all said he'd been part of.
Now, there was a piece in Private Eye about you, Valerie, on the 22nd of February to 2nd of March this year edition, after the headline on in the Daily Express, really questioning whether there was any kind of corroboration for this, and effectively insinuating that you had been making this up.
When there is abuse by itself, it's scary enough. When there is abuse within a religious setting, it is so terrifying to people. Look how long it's taken. The Ryan Report of 2009 took till then to talk about ritualistic kinds of abuse children in Ireland went through at the hands of nuns and priests. So nobody can bear it when it's linked to religion. But when it's linked to a religion that's not mainstream, it seems to frighten people more, as if, yes, abuse exists, Satanism exists, but you couldn't have Satanist abuse. And in fact, at one point I said maybe the whole country should convert to Satanism, because it seems as if Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Christians abuse their children, and Satanists are the only people that don't. So it's not surprising that people find these serious allegations really frightening. Now, I'm not a police officer. I'm a psychoanalyst and a therapist. And what people say in the consulting room is private. But as somebody that's been there at the forefront of getting disclosures from children and adults with a disability for 30 years, where people have asked me to go to the police or speak about something publicly, I have done this with their permission. So, no, I haven't been in a ceremony, but I've seen the marks on them, and I've seen the terror they're in, and I've seen how they were before such events happened, and how they are when they speak about it, how consistent they are in other things they say, so that there has been no reason from a psychological point of view to doubt their capacity to give good evidence. But it's the police that need to find the proper corroboration.
Yeah, maybe not necessarily your job. But why do you think that Private Eye have taken this attitude? Because they are saying in the report, basically, they're saying that this there is no such thing as ritual abuse or satanic ritual abuse.
I found it so disappointing, because from my teens onwards, I always liked Private Eye and always felt they were on the side of people being badly treated. So it was quite a shock. Not just to me, but to all the other people that work with ritual abuse survivors, to have an intelligent, satirical paper take the strange view that no such thing could exist. In the wake of the Kidwelly case, which was a very successful prosecution, in 2011, where four adults were convicted for the ritual abuse of vulnerable children, and where we've got lists of cases that have been successfully prosecuted, to say that nothing exists is creating the kind of climate that allows a Jimmy Savile to exist. In fact, one detective that did work for some survivors made the sort of wonderful point, all you have to do is put on a cloak and a mask and you can get away with doing anything to a child, because people will say it can't be true, it's not real.
Now, you've spoken to five of Savile's victims. What evidence do you have that this is more widespread? You mentioned that Kidwelly case, but what about your own personal experience? Do you think that this is more widespread than we realise, this kind of abuse?
the kind of ritual abuse in a belief system, I've worked or heard from about 500 people in 25 years. And I'm assuming that from what colleagues are telling me that this is not a huge part of abuse. If you think that most abuse in the country, tragically, is within the family, it's incest, or near family, abuse within a ritual that is not, that is family or family and others, I would think is one of the smallest forms of abuse, but one of the most dangerous and damaging, because any child who has been abused is told not to tell and is threatened about what will happen if they tell. But it seems that with ritual abuse, children are told that if they tell, they and people they love will be punished in an afterlife. When you make a kind of religious threat like that, whether you believe it or not, and you're doing it and dressing up to frighten the children, the important thing is the child believes it. And that means that child, even when they're an adult and come for help, are still scared that something terrible will happen after they're dead because they've told on their abusers.
Now, obviously scores of people involved in some of these ritual abuse events where Saville was, and it seems very, very strange. There was very little and no action from the police and the BBC against him. Was he being protected, do you think, by people who were part of those circles who were also potentially part of the police officers or maybe civilian police people or working for the BBC themselves? I mean, it seems incredible that over such a long time there were no prosecutions when clearly people knew about this.
We've seen in the papers today with Stuart Hall, thank heavens, pleading guilty to the molestings he did in his period at the BBC. And we're also hearing through the reporting of the commission looking at the BBC that there haven't been current complaints. So I think there is something important that the nature of obedience and hierarchy in the 21st century and in 2013 is not so heavy as it was 20 years ago. That the way in which children felt they had to obey, and if grown-ups said don't tell, they mustn't tell, has changed. Similarly, if a boss is abusive, an employee is more likely to tell people or make a complaint. We're looking at where wealth and hierarchy join together. Where somebody is a boss of others and has lots of money and mixes in powerful circles, there's greater fear in their victims in speaking out. So I think it doesn't need even a cover-up that when people see somebody that's above them doing something wrong, they think, oh, maybe I'm seeing things, maybe he was drunk, maybe this is the only occasion, and they wipe it out of their mind. So something can be covered up, not through a deliberate cover-up, but because it's just so horrible to consider. It's no different in a family where grandfather is the head of the family and he's physically abusive, and people don't quite want to see it if he's powerful and wealthy and has a job that is highly significant. It's, oh, he's just a bit strict, or he's old-fashioned. There'll be excuses for it.
Now, in a way, Rupert Murdoch, I'm sure, is rubbing his hands quietly because the BBC is getting an absolute drubbing over this. We had a chap called Ben Fellows, who was abused as a child, on here a few months ago talking about his abuse. Do you think this is something? And he was saying it's actually much wider in the entertainment industry as a whole. The idea is that it's kind of fame, and this is a big attraction to young people, and that this is used as a method of abuse. And I mean, you've spoken, you say, to 500 people or so. Would you agree with that, that the entertainment industry actually is a hotbed of abuse?
If we consider the government's own statistics that 1 in 4 people are likely to have been a victim of some kind of abuse, I think we'd find it was spread evenly, that it's wherever vulnerable children are, whether it's teachers, whether it's religious leaders, whether it's family members. It's a hard thing being a child. I think when it comes to entertainment, there is a complicated area of where you've got people that are, for example, really motivated fans of somebody that are above the age of consent, that would be utterly thrilled to be chosen by a singer to go off with them after a concert. And you're not going to have every person in a rock band that's just a few years older working out exactly when people are on the edge of an age of consent. So I think there's painful issues where somebody could do something at a young age, and 10 years later, they can look at it differently. My goodness, I was only 16. How could I have gone to a rock concert and behaved like that? And how could that singer have not realized that I was young and I shouldn't have been doing this? I think they're very hard things there that are very different to paedophilia. And it matters that we are aware of the different seriousness of where a child's hope is destroyed to where a young adult has given in to a boss at work, whether it's a nurse with a doctor, a secretary with the boss, a fan at a concert. There are hierarchy things that are really difficult, and people need help with those. But unless somebody is doing a sadistic, planned, awful molesting of people totally against their wills, as it seems Stuart Hall was and Jimmy Savile was, there's a danger that people that were in a more grey area could get caught up in this.
Okay, if anyone listening's been subject to this sort of abuse, Valerie, or believes someone they know has, what should they do?
Well, there is something very, very important and positive about the Yew Tree project at the moment. You see, one thing that's difficult with the police force is usually you have to go to the police force that are nearest to where the crime happened. And if there's an officer there that you don't feel you can tell, or you don't feel has listened sympathetically, then you're in a real stuck position. But while the Yew Tree project goes on, it has permission to look at things that are connected to Jimmy Savile or our other major names or our other cases where they might make a link with somebody helpful that is nearer to where the person lives.
Okay, Valerie, I suppose the final question has to be, what do you think can be done about this in the long term?
I think the more we consider that any child looking distressed, disturbed, has gone through something, and that we can have a question, what's happened to you? That when an adult is emotionally disturbed, homeless, in pain, something has happened. What is it? Once we start thinking, have they been traumatized? what could have happened to them? We make a climate in which it's easier for people to tell. And once people can tell, the culture of secrecy goes. Just having an open mind. No therapist I know that's worked with extreme allegations of ritual abuse even knew it existed, even had a view over whether they believed it or not. But when faced with it, we've had to see something horrible. The more people can consider that, yes, there can be wrong allegations, there can be emotional disorders that make it hard for people to remember everything properly, but that if we know whatever the worst things are they've happened to people, it will make it more possible to tell.
Okay, Valerie Sinnerson, psychoanalyst specialising in trauma, also director of the Clinic for Dissociative Studies in London. Thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thank you.
Some more Bristol music on BCFM 93.2.
Yes, Martin Summers now joins me. Martin, we're going to talk about Boston. Can you just introduce us to this whole concept of the US now looking at this, many people in the US, although not the mainstream media, it has to be said, as some kind of operation in order to, in a way, it sort of traumatise the public into accepting possibly new laws. We've just had another CISPA law, which is to do with internet, taking away internet freedoms, this kind of thing. What's your take on Boston?
Well, I mean, the mainstream media in Russia and Iran have certainly been looking into these things, so it's not just alternative outlets like ourselves. I think what's very interesting about what's happened is this kind of false flag attack, which, which intelligence services have been carrying out for decades now, we've now got a situation where people basically start asking the right questions straight away, and we've got loads of footage taken, for example, by people's camera phones and so on, which contradicts the official story and so on. Now, of course, they're finding it more and more difficult to keep the lid on what you might call counter-analysis of the event, especially when you've got hostile foreign powers like Russia and Iran who are looking at it very closely as well.
Yeah, what bothers me really is the fact that we've had so little this critical coverage from here. It's almost as if there's no such thing as investigative journalism anymore, or critical journalism, no questions being asked.
Well, I mean, obvious things to say is they've not followed procedure. Why ever not? Why one guy was killed under mysterious circumstances with eyewitnesses contradicting what the official authorities are saying, and the other guy is being held incommunicado without seeing a lawyer. Why would you want to do that if you're playing by the rules?
Earlier this week, I spoke to a US freelance journalist about the Boston bombings and photographer Chris Bolin, and he has put together an interesting set of articles online. And so let's have a listen to Chris Bolin now, US freelance journalist.
My name is Christopher Bolin, and I'm an American independent journalist currently living in Scandinavia. I worked as an American journalist for about a decade in Washington, D.C. I wrote a couple books about September 11th. I wrote Solving 9/11, The Deception That Changed the World, and the second book is my articles that underpin that thesis. It's called Solving 9/11, The Original Articles. I wrote these articles over a period of 11 years. I put forward my hypothesis. But my research got me into trouble in the United States because investigating 9/11 as a crime was not done by the U.S. government. And if you do that, you're going to come to conclusions that the U.S. government really doesn't want made known. It especially got very difficult when we discovered the evidence of this superthermite in the dust. Professor Jones and myself, we worked together. And this led us to the conclusion that the towers had been destroyed using an exotic explosive with incredible firepower. That experience taught me a lot about false flag terrorism. And when the events of Boston occurred in the middle of April, it looked very much like this was the second installment of terrorism for the United States.
But Chris, it was a very different episode, wasn't it? I mean, 9/11 was incredibly spectacular. Many thousands of people were killed, whereas only a handful were killed in Boston.
Yeah, it's very true. I always remember the movie Brazil, which was made by the Israeli Mossadnik Arnon Milchan, made in 1985. It was a Terry Gilliam movie, and the guy who used to work on Monty Python's Flying Circus. And in this movie, that came out in 1985 or 86, the public in the future is constantly harassed by terrorism going off all around them, and terrorism becomes a fact of life. You wind up having this government that is controlling the people through terrorism. I really like to talk to Terry Gilliam and Anna Milchan to find out where they got this idea from, because this is exactly what we are getting. It's exactly what the people of Afghanistan and Iraq and Israel have already had for a long time, the Palestinians as well. But now they are trying to translate this, to bring the same kind of thing to the British people, the American people, the French.
Well, this is certainly going on in, right now in Pakistan, Iraq, Syria, places like this. It's constant. You know, you never know when there's another bomb going to go off, rather like that Brazil. But anyway, going back to Boston, what were the things about that attack that made you think that actually we weren't being told the truth, if that's what you're saying?
Well, the facts are very simple. The special agent in charge of the investigation, the day after the bombing, gave a press conference in which he said that both bombs were packaged in black nylon backpacks. Well, if you look at the images of the two Tsarnaev brothers, Dzhokhar Tsarnaev is wearing a white backpack or a silverish backpack, certainly not black. So right there, your logical conclusion is that, you know, he was not carrying a bomb. There are a number of anomalies. The story that the government has told us about this shootout doesn't make any sense either. You know, they say that the one brother drove his car and ran over his older brother, who was being held down by these police in this street in Watertown. Yet there's an eyewitness, a woman named Linda, who called into a Boston radio show the next following morning and said that she clearly saw, that the vehicle that ran over the man in the street was a police SUV. I've written about this extensively, these various anomalies. This is another thing. If the eyewitness saw the man get run over, and she said two times in this interview that it was a police SUV when she was asked, this is an eyewitness account. You can't just throw it out. Another thing is that the FBI and the police in America, in Boston, told us that these men had carried out a robbery at 7-Eleven. Well, the 7-Eleven company came forward and said, no, that video is not from 7-Eleven. And these men did not rob a 7-Eleven. Okay. Then they said that Dzhokhar Tsarnaev had been armed and had been shooting at the police from underneath the tarp of the boat in the backyard. Well, now the officials come forward and say he was not armed. So, you know, it's one thing after another, so that the police story continues to unravel. One lie after another. So now the question is, what parts of the police story are actually true? And which parts of the police story can be proven? And I haven't seen any. And I submit to you that the Tsarnaev brothers are both lackeys. They're the scapegoats. They're being scapegoated for this crime. And the scapegoating of these men is an absolute atrocity.
Well, that's freelance journalist, US freelance journalist Chris Bolin there, talking about the Boston bombings. He's now living in Sweden. Old Oak Oxford economist Martin Summers, what are your thoughts about, I mean, it does seem, from what he's saying, evidence he's presented there is nothing, if you go into the detailed account that has been presented to the British and American public about the Boston bombings, none of it is true.
Yeah, I mean, obviously when an incident like this happens, one suspends judgment until all the facts gradually become clear. But it fits a pattern of NATO intelligence services involved in terrorism in order to terrorise their own populations, which goes back to the 1960s and 1970s. And I'll repeat again that the head of the Italian Supreme Court, Francesco Imposimosto, has written a book recently about this, making it absolutely clear it was NATO intelligence services who were responsible for the strategy of tension in Italy, which involved bombings in Piazza Fontana, Bologna, and so on. Sybil Edmonds, who's a former FBI translator, has also said that she doesn't believe the story. You've got lots of people and veterans today who are intelligence analysts, ex-US military, who say they don't believe the story. And there's a political subtext to this, which is to do with Chechnya. It looks like the boys had linkages with Western intelligence, but not but basically as agents, possibly. Now, the soup gets very thick, but the thing that people need to hold on to is that what we are being told is a pack of lies from start to finish. And then you have to just ask yourself, well, why? And that's because basically we are getting set for a war with Iran, perhaps an intervention in Syria, and the public has to be softened up. It's cynical, it's crude, but it largely works because people like us talking about it on air doesn't stop these people. A lot of people carry on believing what they're told by the government, whatever.
Drive Time on BCFM 93.2.
Now, the UN has accused the United States of torture over force-feeding Guantanamo Bay detainees this week. 130 of them, Martin, are refusing food, and 23 of them being force-fed. We heard about a squad of medical people actually having to be flown over to Guantanamo Bay to actually conduct this force-feeding.
Well, yes, so we've got all, and we know about Guantanamo Bay, but we also know, although we don't not know about, possibly hundreds of other secret prisons in which people are being held. Now, not only are these prisons and these kind of ways of dealing with the problems illegal, they also create a possibility that all kinds of manipulations can go on. When anything gets too, when any individual gets too, a bit of a nuisance, they can be whisked away into this illegal detention structure, which allows the intelligence service, and I'm not just accusing Western intelligence services here, could be the FSB in Russia, could be Mossad in Israel, it allows them to cover their tracks because they don't have to account for what they're doing. And people should understand that that's the real problem with secret courts and secret prisons. It's not that innocent people may be punished, although I'm quite sure that that's what's going on. It means that the intelligence services can use that to manipulate public opinion in directions where they want it to go.
Well, isn't Guantanamo Bay a history now? We've got drones. People don't need to be taken to Guantanamo Bay.
Well, the problem they've got at Guantanamo Bay is that, and certainly with the British inmates, it's been fairly clear for many years that most of them have no connection with terrorism whatsoever. But the Americans don't want to release them because it will then become apparent that they had no connections for terrorism whatever, that they've been held completely illegally, some of them for up to a decade, and the kind of, you know, basically if they were to sue in a court of law, they would get an awful lot of damages. But of course, we're not even talking about that. What we're talking about here is a lawless state. The United States, with Britain as its loyal ally, has become a lawless state, like Nazi Germany.
Well, it's banned in Britain, that is the Iranian channel Press TV in the English language, but they carried a report this week, Martin, and again, you're talking about the legal stuff. A Guantanamo lawyer was found dead in an apparent suicide. 38-year-old attorney died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound, and he was acting for one or two of the inmates at Guantanamo Bay. The US holds 166 men at the prison, and as we said earlier, 130 are on a hunger strike to protest against prison conditions. No coincidence, of course, that this channel has been banned by Ofcom. We don't see it on British television anymore.
No, but people can find it on the internet, and it showed by banning Press TV, they're demonstrating how scared they are of the kind of exposure that could come about. And I think what's beginning to happen is that the Western media in particular and Western governments have run out of credibility. In shanty towns and slums around the world, basically the Western media is regarded as a joke. And it is a joke.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
On to Iraq. We've had a record April, a record 700 people dead in Iraq and 1,600 wounded. When the Arab League said that an invasion of Iraq would open the gates of hell, seems they were right, Martin.
Yes, it seems they were right. And of course, Iraq and Syria are intertwined crises. The same kind of Sunni insurgents which are bombing Shia mosques in Iraq are bombing Shia mosques in Syria. In the one case, they are kind of being demonised by terrorists, although we don't actually talk about Iraq much anymore. And in the case of Syria, they're being lionised as freedom fighters. Well, and of course, what we're actually dealing with here is Western intelligence manipulation of jihadi groups. They've basically been running these groups for many years as a way of destabilising political opponents. And, of course,
it's more and more complicated as
time goes on.
That's easy to say, but have you got any evidence?
Yes. Well, Operation Cyclone, it's all on the historical record. The biggest secret operation in history set up the Al-Qaeda network to fight the Russians in Afghanistan. And, of course, this is what Sybil Edmonds is saying. People go to her Boiling Frog website. She's an ex-FBI translator. She's saying that, of course, that the same networks were used to fund Chechen terrorists to fight the Russians. Basically, everybody's using terrorists in order to intimidate their enemies, create excuses for intervention, control the minds of the population. And this has been going on for a very long time. I mean, NATO's secret army is a book by Daniel Ganzer, who's a Swiss academic. Frankovich's film on Gladio, GLADO. They're all out. The knowledge is out there, but of course the mainstream media just refuses to look at it because, of course, that couldn't possibly be happening. Therefore, we can't discuss it.
Now,
but of course, the idea that this stuff goes on is absolutely straightforward.
Martin, you mentioned Syria there, very close to Iraq, of course, and Chuck Hagel has confirmed that the United States is now considering arming the Syrian rebels this week.
They already are, and certainly through their proxies in Qatar and Saudi Arabia. So British taxpayers' money is no doubt being funneled into destruction in these countries. Of course, we get involved in all of these things, but we all want to go home and have a nice cup of tea. And then occasionally, let's say that Boston was just blown back by people who were fed up. Can anybody blame people for being fed up? If two people get killed in the US and there's a big hoo-ha, how many people have been killed in Iraq this week? 700, is it? 75? I can't remember. But I mean, it's just, we're moving into a very dark time indeed, all around the world.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
Well, it's International Press Freedom Day today, and talking of which, the NATO Zone Bilderberg Power Elite come to Hertfordshire in June. Let's hope there's a little bit of coverage for it in the British mainstream press. There's only two things to do: arrest all these Bilderbergers for war crimes and fraud, or to party. But it looks like the latter will be what's happening this year. I'm proud to say there's going to be an absolute first here in Britain. It's called the Bilderberg Fringe Festival, an imaginative way of protesting against the world's most powerful criminal cartel. Founded by a Nazi SS officer, Prince Bernhard of the Netherlands, and chaired by him for 20 years, the Bilderberg Conference brings together the arms manufacturers, bankers, royalty and industrialists that control almost all the money in the Western world, and they want to use it to make some more, whoever gets in their way. But this year they face a new and dangerous foe, the British musicians and comedians headlining at the Bilderberg Fringe. Now, it's all taking place near their Hertfordshire Conference Centre on the second weekend in June, as Hannah Bono explains.
Hello. Hi. So, yeah, it is looking extremely likely that the Bilderberg Conference this year is going to be in Watford. Obviously, they don't confirm it, but all the signs point to it. And Jim Tucker did confirm it just before he died, and he's usually accurate. So it'll be at the Grove Hotel in Watford from the 6th to the 9th of June. The hotel will be in lockdown for 5 days, and the police have confirmed that they are undertaking a 10-day security exercise in the grounds of the hotel. The delegates are expected to arrive on the afternoon and evening of Thursday, the 9th of June, and will leave on the morning probably of Sunday. Oh no, they'll arrive Thursday, the 6th of June, and they'll leave on the morning of Sunday, the 9th of June. So at this 3-day conference, we expect UK politicians from both the left and the right to meet in armed privacy with the CEOs of banks, corporations, heads of state, hedge fund executives, presidents and senior officials from influential think tanks and foundations such as the Brookings Institute, the Hudson Institute, the Carnegie Endowment for World Peace, European finance ministers and senior representatives or presidents from the major international institutions will be there: NATO, the EU, the IMF, the World Bank, the European Central Bank and the World Trade Organization. George Osborne has now attended 4 Bilderberg conferences, and as Bilderberg steering committee member Kenneth Clark is always there. Conference regular Lord Mandelson will no doubt be present, and it's possible that David Cameron will attend this year's meeting. Whizzing past us in tinted limousines, we'll be seeing the CEOs and chairmen of banks and corporations such as Barclays, HSBC, Santander, Nestle, Novartis, Airbus, Microsoft, Unilever, AXA, Deutsche Bank, Evercore, Fiat, Siemens, Royal Dutch Shell, Michelin and Goldman Sachs, plus the usual smattering of senior US State Department, Federal Reserve and Treasury officials, national security advisors, Pentagon top brass and the head of the NSA. Long-time Bilderberg participants Henry Kissinger and David Rockefeller will rub shoulders with conference regulars Bill Gates, Eric Schmidt, chairman of Google, and Peter Thiel, founder of PayPal. The Dutch royal family, the Norwegian royal family and always the Spanish royal family as well. And I think Prince Philip did attend once when it was in Scotland. Philip has attended many years ago. I mean, that would be amazing if we could catch one of them going in. But. And just out of interest, Marcus Aegius, a member of the 39-strong Bilderberg Steering Committee, is senior non-executive director of the BBC and sits on the BBC's new executive board. And to give you some idea of the uncanny political intuition illustrated by the steering committee, Barack Obama, David Cameron, Bill Clinton and Tony Blair all attended the conference just before they were elected. The Bilderberg Group doggedly maintains that all participants attend as private individuals, but a recent FOI request from the Treasury revealed that George Osborne attended the 2011 conference in St. Moritz in his official capacity as Chancellor, and the taxpayer paid for his travel. There is also evidence that policies are formulated at this opaque and undemocratic forum. Indeed, former NATO Secretary General and two-time Bilderberg attendee Willy Klaus spoke of how all participants are given reports, feedback from the steering committee on 10-minute presentations they give to the conference. And he said the participants are then obviously considered to use this report in setting their policies in the environments in which they affect. Over the past few years, more and more of us are realising that this completely private policy-forming event is the very antithesis of open participatory democracy. For too long, this yearly conference has taken place under the media radar. More than ever before in this current economic climate, we have a right to know what is discussed when our elected public officials meet privately with the very CEOs of the major banks that they are giving billions to in bailouts. It's high time that this embargo was lifted so this major international summit finally receives the media attention it very much deserves. And with this end in mind, activists from all over the world will be travelling to Watford to shine light upon this meeting and to protest the conference's lack of transparency. Occupy Bilderberg and anti-cuts protesters from the UK will seek out the very architects of austerity as they meet in hiding. Furthermore, this is the fun bit. A group of concerned citizens are this year launching the Bilderberg Fringe Festival, comprising of talks, workshops, comedy and music on the 8th and the 9th of June. Joining the Fringe Festival, and I hope you all will come along over that weekend, is a chance to protest against the pinnacle of corporate lobbying and to witness at close hand the extraordinary power of the military, industrial, financial complex in action. But it's also a chance to network with like-minded people, participate in some fun and uplifting events, and to hear inspiring talks by some of the finest minds in the alternative media today. So if anyone wants to get involved in any capacity with organising the Bilderberg Fringe, helping with the press centre that we also hope to set up, or would like any information at all on this unique weekend, please get in contact with us through the website, which is bilderberg2013.co.uk, where we'll be posting updates and the itinerary as we have it, or the email address that you get is bilderberg2013@yahoo.co.uk. So that's bilderberg2013@yahoo.co.uk. And I hope to see as many of you possible there. It is hectic, but it's great fun. So thanks very much.
Wow, Hannah, thanks very much. Martin, one of the things Hannah mentioned there was that the BBC executive board guy, Marcus Aegius, is there. One thing she didn't say is that he's also one of the senior people at Barclays Bank. I mean, this is a little bit unhealthy, isn't it, when you've got someone who's making big decisions about what programmes are going to be made and which programmes aren't going to be made. And they're also, I don't imagine that he's going to be commissioning programmes about LIBOR fraud, for example.
No, indeed. And of course, if I could come back to Francesco Imposimosto, who I mentioned earlier, is the head of the Italian Supreme Court, has just published a book in which he says Bilderberg were behind the Gladio terrorism in Italy in the 1970s and the 1980s. So he specifically accuses the Bilderberg group of being behind things like the Bologna bombing, the Piazza Fontana bombing. This is the head of the Italian Supreme Court. For the gangsters, the time is up.
Driving home with BCFM 93.2, the station you can count on.
quite proud that it's happening here in Britain as well for the first time. And I'm joined now by John McAnally. Now, John, tomorrow's May Day march and rally from College Green reaches Castle Park around about 12:30, starts at 11 o'clock, I believe, down at the Council
House. That's right, yeah.
It brings together critics of the coalition government from all over the region. One person who's likely to be there is you. You're National Vice President, I believe, of the Public and Commercial Services Union. What is Public and Commercial Services Union, PCS?
Well, it's a union of around 260,000 civil servants. We also have some private sector or commercial sector members as well, who are, whose companies are delivering contracts to government. So we deliver the kind of services that I think people first of all take for granted, but which are now under threat by the austerity programme, you know, passports, benefits, tax, etc., etc. And, you know, we will be speaking tomorrow and making the point that austerity isn't working, or perhaps I should revise that. It's working for a very tiny elite in society who are raking in the profits while the rest of us are facing falls in living standards. We're facing cuts in services. And I think the austerity programme is turning this country, turning Europe, in fact, into a very, very brutal place indeed. And one thing I'm confident about is, despite all the problems we have, that people are beginning to wake up to the myths that are being fed through the press and by the politicians, that there's no alternative to austerity, when in actual fact there is an alternative based on job creation, investment, tax justice, that simple idea.
Hang on a second, yep. John, because where's the money going to come from for this? We keep being told that, I'm afraid, the credit card is maxed out, there is no more money, and you're pie in the sky if you're thinking, oh yes, well, we could just create jobs out of nowhere.
And that, of course, is a central myth, and it's been quite successful in saying that the big problem in terms of the economy is unaffordable public spending, rather than the fact that the unregulated banks and big business have had a free hand for so often. They've made a complete mess of the economy. Let's investigate this question of no money around at all. We live in the fourth or fifth, I can't quite remember which, richest country in the world. But there's something like £750 billion that the big companies are sitting on. They won't invest. You know, we talk about strikes and so on, but there's an investment strike going on at the present time, mainly because there's a lack of confidence. That's certainly one factor, but also because they can't make enough profit. And public spending, of course, is not the big problem here. For every job that is cut in the public sector, at least one, probably two, and sometimes even three, is cut in the private sector. This, you know, childish notion that there's some kind of massive wall between public and private, public and private spending, or public and private sector, is an absolute nonsense. So what we need to do is invest. There's loads of money around. If you go to London, where I spend quite a lot of time, you see that there's plenty of wealth around. That it's just not always in the right hands. What we need is redistribution, a fair taxation system, and we need investment. But we've got to challenge these myths that somehow the fault of public spending.
Aren't you actually just simply there to protect your members' jobs? I mean, I don't know how much it costs to become a member of your union, but isn't that actually what you're doing? You're just saying, well, look, actually, the government is trying to fix the economy. We're finding that our members are losing jobs, and so we're going to fight them. And actually, you're actually an unprincipled person. You're just trying to fight to save your members' jobs. You don't care about the economy.
Well, of course we're trying to fight to save our members' jobs, as any trade union would. But one of the things is, in fact, that the accusation of this government against the PCS is, of course, that we're involving ourselves in politics. And what I mean by that, Tony, is they're saying that we've really got no right to comment on the government policy. They say austerity is the official programme of the government. We have no right to criticise that. Well, I remember the last general election, and I don't remember any politician saying they were going to dismantle the health service and privatise. I don't remember any politician saying they were going to brutalise the welfare system. I don't remember any politician saying they were going to drop living standards between 16 and 20%. So people have got to speak out. And it's not just about protecting our members' jobs. We are taking industrial action at the present time. Yes, it's about protecting jobs. Yes, it's about stopping privatisation. What it's essentially about, Tony, is protecting our services, because we're going to become a very brutal country, and indeed, if we don't protect these services.
So what's the bottom line? What does it cost to join PCS?
Oh, right. Well, it's quite cheap. I mean,
you would say that. Yeah, you're a salesman now, aren't you?
No, well, as a matter of fact, in comparison to other unions, yeah, it's fairly cheap. You know, you membership for about £9 or £10 a month, I think. I hope I've got that right. I should know. But it's round about that.
Okay. And what do you get for your money?
Well, you get all the services you might expect from a trade union. You get legal representation and or access to legal advice and so on. But the essential thing that you get as a union is protection. All joining a union does is give you insurance for your job. People get insurance for their house, they get insurance for their car. All joining a union is getting insurance for your job and your rights at work. And those rights at work are under constant attack. And what this government's trying to do, with the help of the press and so on, is to create this nonsense about trade unions that we're all selfish. It's all about special interests and protecting ourselves, and they're the ones who care about the country. Let me tell you this about privatisation. This happened under the last government. It's going to happen under the next government. They bring in private contracts, and then when they go out of government, they sit on the boards of those same companies raking in billions. It is utterly corrupt.
Thanks very much. That's John McAnally there, who was the National Vice President for the PCS Union. That's all for now. Sorry?
Sorry, as National Vice President.
Is.
Towards. Thank you.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, you've come back again. Okay. Time to sign off. Thanks for our guests in the first hour. Last year's Green Party candidate for Mayor, Daniela Radici, now also the councillor for Bishopston as of today. And thanks to that, you just heard John McAnally from PCS, and also to Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, food and farming. How are farmers getting on in the southwest countryside? I'm Tony Gosling. This website, the website for this programme is thisweek.org.uk. We'll see you next week.
3.2 online and on your mobile. BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News.